I'm Patricia Matthews. I joined CINI on November 1st, so very recently. As an English language teacher, I focused on helping people communicate more clearly and more conscientiously. With CINI, I'll be supporting various projects as Suring ushers in the new decade. Suring, I'm so happy to interview you about the first years and the future of CINI. When we first met in June, I had such a lovely connection with you and Eden and Kempo Suring Nyima. It turned out that wasn't the time for me to join you, but I'm here now. I'm so new. I feel like I've landed in some complex, multidimensional, multinational mandala. So my first question is about beginner's mind.
Yes. What a wonderful way to begin, Patricia. And I just want to say thank you. Thank you for agreeing to do this interview. I know you mentioned, you said, well, I'm the newest person. Am I the right person to interview you? And I said, yes, because I find it fun and interesting when a person is new, ask questions that are unexpected, kind of allow me to zoom back out, see the big picture. So thank you. It's a wonderful first question, actually. In terms of beginner's mind, I think that's in a way where I have begun on all of my major projects.
Mm-hmm.
Tartong Rinpoche, my father, has a great ability, and I've written about this in some places, but he has a great ability of pairing you with an activity that you may not have any experience with or knowledge, but somehow energetically, he thinks you might be the right person for that activity. So a beginner's mind, I think that's true. That's kind of how I approach things. But I've also been very fortunate to be given activities where some of my own natural strengths or areas of interest sort of come out. And maybe in a way they come out just because that's what I need to use in order to get the work done. But beginner's mind to me is coupled with open mind. And with this open mind, we can start in a pretty humble place. And that can be really challenging. Sometimes I'm often given work that is well beyond my own knowledge and expertise. I think now, a decade into CINI, I have come to the sort of simple realization, to remind myself, that it's okay to not know. I may not know now. I actually may not know even in the end, but I'll try to help create an open space that allows others to join. My role is really then connecting.
So I was reading about your father's instructions when you started this project, connecting East and West and constructing on the North-South axis. So can you give me an example of how your beginner's mind or your open mind sort of worked in those very early days of that project?
That's really fun that you've asked this question about the north, south, and east, west axis, because when I was starting to build the Institute, and this was back in 2008, so it's even earlier than the 2013 inauguration, we sort of broke ground, started with drawings. And I asked my father, Rinpoche, who's been engaged in really large cultural preservation projects for decades and has built a number of temples and beautiful sacred monuments. But I'd never done anything like that. I've seen it from the side, but I've never actually led a project. So when I asked for instructions for how it should look, he said, well, the temple should open on the north-south axis in the same way that the Mahabodhi Temple in Sarnath. And I was looking at him with big eyes, saying, are there more instructions? And he didn't really give any more. So that was the first instruction about an entire campus was, okay, make the north-south axis, build it on the north-south axis. Then in terms of purpose or mission, he turned to me, I think, at a later conversation. In a later conversation, he said, this Institute's purpose is to help bridge the East and the West. And later on, when I actually built up the institute and I would give tours of the place, I would start at the Bodhi tree, which is right there in the center of our campus. And I'd say, you know, we start with this north-south instruction and then an east-west. And when I look at it, I think, oh, that's a full circle. So I thought what is magical about instructions for the beginner's mind is that you can meet them with creativity and intelligence and openness where you start to fill it out. So Rinpoche has a vision that he does not give to me in detail, but a kind of something larger. And I think this is where, in a way, projects that have a deeper spiritual or blessing, the force of blessing and goodness that transforms a simple instruction into something that's quite deep and meaningful that you can actually use. I sometimes think of these as almost mathematical equations that you kind of have to figure something out and then it reveals a deeper truth. And I had a lot of experience about what the north-south meant, its implication for solar energy, what east-west meant in its own direction. So in terms of connecting not only the geographical space of east and west, which is kind of, in a way, a simple term, but between the tradition and the modern life and other elements of time.
Building in this way is a tradition in many, many belief systems. You know, considering the direction of a space or of a structure on a space, there's a cosmology that I don't know anything about really, but I know that there's something. I think this is when I said, you know, oh my gosh, I'm in this multidimensional mandala. What's going on here? It's so amazing. You know, and as you say, it was a very simple direction, but it touches on so much and it creates what I'm assuming everyone says is a fabulous space. I can't wait to get there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's, and that's nice for the listener of this recording to keep in mind that, you know, Patricia, you haven't been there yet, but
I
really appreciate that you've read and looked at our website and kind of gotten to know it through images and the text. Mm. But Sini has a really beautiful sort of embodied space. And it's important to remember that it's less than a kilometer from where the Buddha gave his first teachings, turning the wheel of the Dharma. Sometimes you can kind of almost do these mental exercises of, wow, you know, I'm just right here. The history is on this land. It's very possible that the Buddha, Bodhisattvas have walked on this hallowed ground and, you know, generations and generations of farmers and people and villages have passed through. But when I was given the land, it was a completely empty space. It was flat with not a single tree. And it was kind of used as a cricket field by the local, you know, children. So it has been really transformed. Another thing that I'll mention just here for a moment about kind of witnessing transformation, which this 10th anniversary allows us to kind of take a moment to say, hey, what happened over those last 10 years? Well, one thing that happened was watching all the trees actually grow. And I look at the trees and I say, they are my kind of clock. They are my timepiece. Because there was nothing. There was not a single tree on that land. And now when you look around, and especially the Bodhi tree that is marked on December 13th, 2013, as the little sapling that now is, you know, this incredible, beautiful tree that expands in all directions. And, you know, the monks and students all circumambulate it daily. So, that's another way of seeing the time and space change.
I like to think that as much as it was physically a blank slate, that when you're seeing that growth, that it's like what contributes to the success of the tree, of the entire location is the history that's embedded in that space. You know, that it is, as you were saying, it's like way before. You know, your father's time, there was you know, there's all sorts of energies there. So that's,
yeah. And I think that's the role of our historians and our, you know, storytellers, and the way that, you know, we're not just in this present moment and seeing, you know, sometimes not a beautiful scene of garbage and pollution and, you know, things that are not so attractive to the eye, but actually when you really imagine the history of a place, you need to read into the books.
So I'm wondering, because you're talking about, you know, history, can you tell me a story of a challenge that you faced with Sini and how you moved through it? An early challenge, I want to say pre-COVID, because that was a different time.
You know, this is probably not the kind of thing you should say, you know, in interviews. I've heard that you say something, you tell a story that actually makes you look good. Like, you know, my worst quality, what's your, you know, worst quality? Well, I'm a perfectionist. I really try to please people. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to give you an example that will look good, but I'll tell you one that has been a challenge from the beginning, and it continues to be a challenge, but I'll tell you a little bit about how I work through it. So it's a challenge to sometimes keep going. In education, you have to have your feet in a way planted while all the birds come and go from your branches. And that's hard. I don't think I have totally gotten used to it in a way. A lot of the projects that I've done in the past have been ones where they had a finite, you know, timeline, or I finished a construction, or I did some project that, you know, had a definite end. And in education, you kind of continue on. And I think that's a challenge. But I think also, in addition to that, one of the challenges that I've faced is with this very kind of multifaceted work that I do with people from all different parts of the world, from different socioeconomic backgrounds, from people who've had no exposure to the so-called modern world, to people who live a very traditional life. And they're all in one pot or one campus. It's kind of unusual in that sense. Mm-hmm. So sometimes the challenge is the communication, that is both barriers in language, the barriers in culture and background. All of those things can be really challenging. And I don't think in a way they'll ever completely go away. But the way that I've worked with that is to try to be, in a sense, very essential and simple. Everybody has a feeling of wanting to belong. Mm. So everyone has a feeling, even those who are total introverts, which there's a wonderful place for introverts at our institute too, because the contemplative life should kind of have little spaces away. You know, it's fine for people to be part of a community at the, you know, meal time and prayer time, but it's also very fine for you to be on your own in your own room and practicing or studying or whatever you're doing. So this sense of belonging, I've found, you know, in terms of sort of transforming that challenge of difference and gaps, it's by doing things kind of simply together. We have, as a kind of cultural quality at Sini, where, you know, we all help with either cleaning or cooking. It's not very hierarchical in a way. Mm-hmm. And I think that has been something where you can work side by side with someone that may have a very different background. You get to know them through their work and in a different way than just what a conversation. Right. Or something that just rests in the head. So that's something that's a way that I've kind of managed some part of that challenge. But there have been many challenges, and they continue to be challenges. I think it's the resilience to the challenges that has to grow over time, and that's part of the maturing process.
I think it's also, isn't it? It's also, as you say, it's that of knowing when the times are to take that break, you know, to do something else, to take a break.
Oh, absolutely.
I think, as you mentioned, though, the you know, just the diversity of people and their mm-hmm. backgrounds that there, I think if you lost that, if that wasn't there, and if it wasn't a challenge, you'd lose so much of the richness of, mm-hmm. of what you've created. You know, I think it's part of the aspect of education or international education that I found so appealing. And one of the reasons I'm so excited to about going there and seeing it and experience it, but all even just doing, you know, the little bit of work I've done with you so far. I know challenges are one part of your work and your story, but what about miracles? What miracles do you especially cherish when you think about your 10 years?
There really have been so many. Now, I thought I was going to just focus on the challenges, but miracles have been just as many, if not more, than the challenges. The miracles are presented in so many different ways, but I think the miracle of the way in which somehow just the right people come together and the right people, well, that may not sound so good in a way, but the right people come to the project. And it's like, if the project is starting to form, then somehow these sort of angels sort of come together and say, you know, I'd like to work on this project. And I thought, wow, I was really looking for a person who has that background, and they suddenly appeared on my doorstep. So there are lots of miracles like that feel very rewarding.
In case people who are watching this or listening to this haven't read it or read about it, what about the rabbit, the bunny?
That's a funny story.
It is.
Well, it is. It's one of the things, and I happen to have that. I keep that still as a profile photo in a few places. This little rabbit was actually, this was in, I think, around 2019, maybe. I was on Facebook, and this llama said that he had rescued a rabbit in Bodh Gaya, and it had been chased in the village area of Bodh Gaya, and he was looking for a home for it, and he was on the train from Bodh Gaya to Varanasi. So I happened to see this online, and I said, well, I'll take this rabbit. So he appears, this llama and this rabbit in his backpack, appears at the stupa in Sarnath, and we are there for a very big ceremony, and it's the full moon. So in Tibetan kind of culture, the rabbit and the full moon is just, you know, it's just full of stories about, you know, the rabbit and the full moon. But so this rabbit in a backpack appears at the stupa, the Dhammaka stupa, and I meet this rabbit, and he's kind of tucked inside this nice sort of fabric backpack. Mm-hmm. And apparently he's been eating rice and dal. So the rabbit's eating rice and dal. Mm-hmm. And we bring him back to the institute. Oh, and by the way, I think some of the lamas had said, you know, this is a very auspicious sign.
Absolutely.
It could be something, you know, kind of connected to the longevity of the Dharma and also of Rinpoche.
Mm-hmm.
So I took the rabbit back and I brought him into the temple. I noticed his markings. And the rabbit, literally, with a very unique patterning of beige and some spots and white, was basically painted maybe 5 years, 6 years before mm-hmm. by this wonderful artist who's also my friend, Kaveri. Mm-hmm. So I looked at that and I thought, what an extraordinary coincidence. And this rabbit, who we named Jigme, which means fearless in Tibetan, had quite an extraordinary life and kind of a beloved animal of the institute. I mean, the story I could take a whole interview just on this, but I won't. But I do need to say one thing about it.
Yes.
Because it's quite a miracle, actually. So I was very fond of this rabbit for a lot of different reasons, but I left during COVID. The monks, students, and staff were taking care of the rabbit. Well, unfortunately, one day, a cat came to the rabbit's cage, and I was told that the cat didn't actually eat the rabbit or really attack the rabbit, but rabbits, you know, he might have died of fright.
Yes.
So he died. And I had been writing a book during COVID. Prior to his death, I had written a little passage about this amazing connection that we have with this rabbit. The book was printed, and I got the news of this rabbit, Jigme's death. And my father, who I was with at the time, you know, really noticed that that I was sad.
Yes.
And we were at our stupa, and we were walking around, and suddenly this new idea came about where we would start a little fund that was called the Fearless Rabbit Fund. And this fund was to help volunteers in our community do a project that would enhance their skills and connection to the mandala. And I was walking with my father, and we were talking about this, and he turned to me and he said, "This rabbit will help generate more merit than maybe any rabbit." And I thought, wow, what an amazing opportunity. And I am so grateful for, in a way, the way that love and affection and even a form of attachment, no doubt, can be opened up and then offered. And so he is for sure a little miracle bunny for me.
Yes.
And
right.
A teacher in a way, in some sense. So thank you for asking that question.
Well, that was, as you say, it's a miracle. It's just a beautiful story, I think, of the history and so I'm wondering too, because, you know, we've talked about, you know, challenges and miracles. You know, as I'm coming to know you, you seem to embody humility and collaboration, and you facilitate, you know, you find expertise, and you've already noted, you know, sort of people come to you, which is so handy, such a gift. In the early years, who are some of the experts, the stars who came to you?
That's a wonderful question also, because it seems like when you're really struggling, there's kind of an, hello, is anybody there?
Mm-hmm.
You're all there on your little island. Well, I was very fortunate to have one of my father's senior students, and who had, you know, worked on some of his temples over 40 years, Doug. And he came out and helped finish the construction. And he had been a football coach. And so in addition to being a Buddhist practitioner, but his football coaching, I think, somehow really worked well for me, because he had a very down-to-earth, grounded approach to problems and challenges, which was, take it one day at a time. Let's do one day at a time. If in the beginning you look out and you just see how overwhelming the situation is, you know, it's very hard to move. So it was one day at a time, and one day at a time became 1 month, and longer and longer. That, by the way, is, I think, an important sign of transformation, is when you're doing both the day at a time, but the longer your time horizon is, I think, is a good indication of a certain kind of groundedness that you have reached. And I have found that now at this mark, I can think about things that are going to have a longer impact, because there's a stability. And so I think, wow, my father was talking about, and has been talking about, things that will last 100 years, 500 years, 1,000 mm-hmm. years. That was inconceivable to me as a child, in a sense.
Right.
But now I sort of understand, you know, what we need to do in order to prepare a ground, an institutional ground, or a program, so that we can actually think really far and be willing to do the day-to-day, but to have that, you know, longer time horizon in mind, keep that in mind, so that a vision starts to have a sharper and clearer focus for you to actually sort of work towards that.
You've almost led me into the next question, but I feel like you had a thought that should be spoken.
Well, I just, you know, in terms of the stars, there were yes. you know, different people that have come along the way, you know, and one of the many treasures who have been at CINI, both the monastics that have been there, early monastics that continued on, even we were we were just, you know, two, three students, and, you know, one teacher. I'm so grateful that they had the confidence and trust in me that, you know, we could continue working even though we were so small in the beginning. And there were others, artists and friends who really helped out and executed visions when we were really just at the beginning. But there are honestly too many to name stars, but you can look at our slideshow that's going to be prepared for this celebration and our website to read more about some of these wonderful people and those that have just really given amazing commitments to this work.
I think you were speaking about your father and his vision, and it's, you know, every time I learn more, it's like, whoa, how does he do that? In the film Publishing Dharma that I watched, I was struck by the images of the printing house of the Derge Monastery in Tibet. You know, that massive collection of woodblock carvings. And, you know, that it said, this is the size of a football field. And you're going, whoa, just, and, you know, I'm, you know, I teach language. I'm a word person. And you're going, that's astonishing. How amazing. What I was thinking then is that was the database of that time and the technology. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little about the current technology projects at CINI, because I know that's, it's just, it's both a current and new direction that's coming up.
I've been really thinking about our human ability to record our memories and understandings in the written word, like you said, you know. Mm-hmm. I've also been surrounded by the sacred written word and presses. And of course, you know, those who know Rinpoche's story and in the film, The Great Transmission, it begins in Tibet with his teaching, receiving the teachings, but it also in a way really begins in Sarnath and Varanasi with starting the first publishing house called Dharma Mudranalaya, which would then later on become Dharma Publishing. And this major now 50-year-long effort of cultural preservation, text preservation. So there have been in our human civilization different chapters of how we record our understanding and what we are doing to preserve the line of transmission of wisdom in the Dharma. And from the oral tradition to, I think also even the visual tradition is a kind of passing of knowledge too. So the visual, the oral, the text written down from woodblock to eventually, you know, the typesetting there to the microfilm work that, you know, has been also a technology that was introduced to.
I forgot about microfilm. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And that's a big part. So there's, you know, when you look at all the mediums, and now we're headed into this digital age and this new level of very creative, challenging, mysterious world of AI. And we are at a juncture at CINI and looking at what's the potential for using AI machine translation to begin with of Tibetan to English in a very big project that we've been working on, which is the Khandzir Karchak, or the summary of the Buddha's teachings. And we're working with UC Berkeley and a few wonderfully creative and smart people there, and also other members in the Tibetan community too, who have been really innovative in their approach to AI and Tibetan. So what is this next generation, this next chapter of looking at AI and Tibetan text preservation? But probably not just preservation. It's probably also going to have an impact on the way we teach and the transmission. So the big question to me, and it's such a simple one, but it's the big question to me is, like, what do we actually need to know if so much is contained in the computers, in the books? And, you know, so now we have an incredible amount of texts available and spanning very easily. And there are organizations like BDRC, founded by Jean Smith and others that have just done tremendous work in the preservation and digitizing Tibetan texts. All of this is now, like, on one hand, choose which one, the right hand, mm-hmm. you have this huge amount of textual information, and more than you've ever had probably in the history of the Dharma. It's just more and more is available. And on the other hand, you have the person who's interacting with this information and kind of treasury of knowledge. You can have, you know, different responses. One is this, you know, Mount Everest, which I cannot climb because it's too big, and I simply will stay down on the base camp. Mm-hmm. I'll stay down at the bottom. I'll just stay here because it's simply too much. Or will I attempt to scale it? Or how will I interact with this huge mountain of knowledge? How do I approach it? I think that's going to be one big question that individuals in society will have to grapple with, is how do you relate to the availability of so much knowledge?
You know, as you were saying that, I was thinking about you talking about, was it Doug who was the football coach?
Yeah.
You know that we'll do it is like one day at a time is kind of so cliche, but it's also that I don't have to know everything about Buddhism. I follow some path that's unfolding as I move along it in my own practice and studies. And I feel that, and if we keep it, you know, simply to translating the Dharma, sorry, that seems even disrespectful to use simply with that, but that it's, you know, as I've looked more at AI in the past days and the questions around it, that I wonder if your question isn't almost, it is a big question, but it's almost maybe too big, you know, sort of what would be the, for you yourself, no, you're not going to climb, you know, Mount Everest. I'm not either, but I know I like to scramble up some of the, you know, some of the trails in Boulder where I live. Yeah, I think it's, I wonder how we bring it down, I guess would be my question, is that it's not to get lost in the big question.
Not to get lost in the big question. I think that's really helpful and calming advice for our friends. One of the thoughts that I had is that this has actually always existed in a sense. There's a mm-hmm. beautiful number, and it's 84,000. And apparently the Buddha gave 84,000 teachings to match the minds, like the perfect medicine for the 84,000 mental dispositions or something like that. So there's always something for everyone, especially in the Dharma in that sense. We are trying to understand the nature of our own minds, and the teachings come at it in manifold ways. And I think if we can approach AI, there's a lot of work that's being done with people looking at human-centered AI and the ethics around it and all of that. Of course, that's really important. I really hope that our monastics will have a seat at this probably virtual table, but we'll have a seat at this virtual table, not just as passive recipients to the technology, but let's look at what's the greatest benefit that could be provided with AI in our work. How could we use this technology as a tool to really alleviate the suffering, to awaken the minds, to open the hearts? What could we do? And how would we use it? Let them have a seat at this table. Important for the future of not only our community and the Buddhist world, but hopefully for humanity. I feel we are deeply connected. We already had a pretty large digital divide. And with AI, I feel like we've just faced another huge chasm. There are only a few people that I know that can kind of explain what's happening. And even the experts seem a bit befuddled by things like hallucinations and whatever happens of computers just sort of taking on things that weren't even programmed. I mean, it's quite
right. Yeah, it is. I think looking at all the changes in text in your father's lifetime, in my lifetime, in your lifetime, it can be it can shake us up, you know, which it is doing. It's not the first time we've had technology shake us up. It just seems to be doing it at a faster pace. I have a question. This came up in one of our meetings, and I love this question, and it might be a way that we have to, sadly, and all my questions. I have, of course, many more, but I loved how this came up. It's like, who is Cindy now? As you think about 10 years of creation and development and expansion.
In a way, it's perfect that you just asked this question right before this about AI, and then me talking about how, you know, something's happening that I don't even know about during the pandemic and have had to be away and on virtual call. And there have been a lot of programs that have developed in the wake of the pandemic that have, you know, had to use Zoom and other ways of connecting. Cindy, in a way, is developing a lot on its own. There's a tremendous force of activity that's happening in our Tibetan language program. You know, we have wonderful colleagues there, and that's expanding our English for Dharma Purposes program and our Khandra Karchuk program. And then each of those programs, along with some of the Dharma programs that are being taught at Cindy, each program is unfolding and developing its new shape and form. So Cindy, in a way, is a little bit like it's beginning to run some parts by itself autonomously. So the self-driving Cindy is my dream. I think that's where we're going to head. But if we use our compass to end what has been actually a real pleasure having this conversation with you, Patricia, and I want to say thank you so much for engaging deeply with the material and coming with a beginner's mind and an open heart. It's been really fun. I would say that looking to the future of what Cindy is and hopes to be, I really hope that we can be a community that, as our guiding principle of trying to benefit others in creative ways and through the Dharma, that, you know, I still can remain open for, which is something that I feel Rinpoche has really taught me all my life, to see the possible connections with any field of human creativity. There's a place really for all. So I hope Cindy remains open. I hope it remains doing good work. I love to collaborate. So thank you very much for this wonderful time together. I really appreciate it.
It's been absolutely my pleasure.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.